Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, 93XRT radio host Terry Hemmert chats with critically acclaimed singer-songwriter Joan Osborne about the music industry, songwriting, and her cover album, Songs of Bob Dylan. This conversation originally took place May 18, 2019, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I'm going to just apologize for my guitar playing right up front. So it's not very strong, but we'll do what we can. You may be an ambassador to England or France. You might like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You're gonna have to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You might be a rock and roll addict prancing on the stage. Money and drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You're gonna have to serve somebody. It may be the devil, or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You might be a state trooper, you might be a young Turk. You might be the head of some big TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame. Maybe living in another country under another name. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Yeah, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You might be a construction worker working on a home. You might live in a mansion, you might live in a dome. You may own guns, you may even own tanks. You might be somebody's landlord, you might even own banks. Gonna have to serve somebody. You're gonna have to serve somebody, yeah. Yeah, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. You may be a preacher with your spiritual pride. You might be a city councilman taking bribes on the side. You might work in a barbershop, you might know how to cut hair. You might be somebody's mistress, you might be somebody's heir. You might like to wear cotton, you might like to wear silk. You might like to drink whiskey, you might like to drink milk. You might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. You may be sleeping down on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Gonna have to serve somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Yeah, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Oh, it may be the devil. Oh, it may be the Lord. You're gonna have to serve somebody. All right. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, Joan, the last time I saw you perform was at City Winery last year when you did the Bob Dylan tour.
Yeah.
And it was brilliant. And I couldn't believe, because his writing is so dense and there's so many words, that you remembered every single word. You were just, and then I was like, wow, she can not only sing, she remembers all those lyrics. And she didn't even write them. And then you came out for your encore. I don't know if you remember this, but you did One of Us, which is your hit, and you messed up the lyrics. And you had to stop and start it. And it was precious. I think it was the highlight of the concert. You were so sweet. And you didn't write that song, but it's your song. I mean, it's
I've certainly done it enough times. You would
I think you've done it a couple. But, and I'm also was thrilled to hear that you're, you know, as a great writer, we want to talk about your writing, but you were an amazing interpreter of song, and you're inspired to do this because of Ella Fitzgerald. I think that's, if you could explain that, that's
a wonderful connection. Well, I mean, I'm pretty fortunate in the sense that I'm known just as much for being just a singer as I am for being a songwriter. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I can walk on both sides of that street. And as you mentioned, Ella Fitzgerald, she put out a series of records in the late 1950s and I believe in the early 60s as well. And each record was devoted to the work of a different songwriter. So she had a Cole Porter record, and she had a Duke Ellington record, and she had a Harold Arlen record, and you know, all these sort of guys who are sort of the giants of the American songbook. And I always, you know, and I had that collection for a long time, and I always thought this would be a really cool way to do something of my own, is to kind of filter it through the lens of, you know, the writers that I really am connected with and that I really love and that I learned so much from and that are more contemporary. So, you know, hopefully this will be the first in a series, you know, record.
Have you even thought about who will be next?
Yeah, I have. I mean, it's kind of like between Tom Waits and Lou Reed. They're kind of duking it out in my mind right now. So
a double album.
Yeah. Both, I don't know who's going to be next. Yeah,
yeah.
But it's such a, to me, it's an exciting, you know, idea for a project, because it's not something that that you have to, like, you can do it at any time. You know, it doesn't have to be like a particular moment, because these writers are so classic.
Sure.
And as long as I can still sing, then knock on wood, then I'll be able to do it.
You could do Cole Porter too if you wanted to. I mean, you're such a versatile singer.
I don't know. Maybe when I'm 85, you can wheel me out and I'll, you know, do my American Standards thing.
But my point is, though, you're so versatile. You know, you pick Bob Dylan, who's known as a folk musician. Mm. But to me, one of the all-time great cover versions of anybody in any genre was you with the Funk Brothers singing What Becomes of the Broken Hearted. If you haven't seen that yet, that's your homework assignment.
Thanks.
Oh my God, you kill that song. It's just, but what was it like to be playing with these gentlemen who played on all these great Motown songs, for you to be up there, this little white girl up there singing with this all-star cast? But I think I would have fainted if I was you, but you just came through. And
I mean, I definitely
so
had
soulful.
To pinch myself a little bit, you know, during the process. Because, I mean, this if you don't know about the film, it's called Standing in the Shadows of Motown, and it focuses on the guys who were in the studio band for all those Motown hit songs. And so they played on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, you know, number one hit records, not to mention all these amazing albums, you know, like Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, and just some classic records. So, of course, I knew their work, but, you know, I walked in there on the first day and walked into the trailer, and they thought I was the makeup girl. You know, they had no idea who I was. So it was kind of like, well, actually, I'm going to be singing with you guys a little later, but, you know, but you look good, and, So it that sort of was like, you know, I'm just going to be here and do my thing, and nobody is, you know, it was all about these guys. So I was not the special one in the room, and I was just like, all right, I'm here to do a job. And once I started rehearsing with these guys, you know, they sounded just like the records, if not better. You know, these were guys who came up playing jazz, and they were excellent musicians.
Right.
And, you know, Berry Gordy sort of cherry-picked them, and they worked together so much for so many years that they became this cohesive unit, and they had this almost like this group mind thing going on. So being able to stand up and sing in front of them, it was you know, it just sort of catapulted me up, and I felt like I could do anything.
You sounded inspired, you know.
I was.
And you could tell by watching the musicians that they were really loving you. I mean, it was really, it's a very sweet moment. You should watch the whole documentary, but tonight your homework assignment is to get on YouTube and see it, because you have to. I mean, it's just really one of my all-time favorite vocal performances. I'm not just saying that to be polite. It was great. But you have done other soul covers and done great, and you've worked with one of our favorite residents of Chicago, Mavis Staples.
Oh, yes.
And,
yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And there's another clip of you and Bonnie Raitt singing with Mavis, but then you toured with her, too.
Yeah, I got to tour with Mavis for a couple of months in, I guess it was 2 or 3 years ago now. And, I mean, this was a huge thing for me, because I, you know, once I started singing, there were just a handful of people that, you know, of course I love, but Mavis was one of my, just, she was like my, one of my top 2 or 3 singers, and I idolized her, and I tried to sound like her, and also I had seen her many, many times in concert over the years, and I just was so impressed by, you know, not only her voice, of course, but she has this presence and this aura that is so joyful. And I remember seeing her in the gospel tent at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival one year, when Pop Staples was still alive and when the family group was still together. And, you know, of course, they all got up and they started singing. And then Mavis steps to the front, and there was just something so beatific about her presence and so wonderful. And I was just floored. So it was really a privilege to get to see her do that every night, to get to go up on stage with her every night. And in particular, you know, she also is totally and completely inclusive. And she sings songs that have a political resonance. You know, they do that song, you know, "Stop, yeah, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down." So, you know, these are, you know, the songs that she chooses have a political resonance. Mm. But she's not up there shaking her finger at everybody and saying, "You got to do this," or "Shame on you for not doing that." It's a total thing of, like, everyone is welcome. And it just was such a lesson for me to of what a person in that position, what a singer and what a musician can do and what they can be, and make this bridge between you and the audience, and then between the audience members and each other. And she did that every single night, and I was just so impressed by that.
She really reaches people and touches them in a profound way, and young people too.
Yeah.
You know, when she was booked to play Lollapalooza, she was terrified, and she wrote to me, and she calls me Pastor. Pastor, these kids won't know who I am. And I said, "Mavis, their favorite word is authenticity, and I don't know anyone more authentic than you. You'll be fine. Just be Mavis."
Yeah.
And sure enough, she took them down Freedom Highway.
Oh, yeah.
She took them to church. She got their backfield in motion.
Mm-hmm.
What more can one woman do? But and now she's playing Bonnaroo and Coachella, and she's loving it.
Oh, yeah. She's on such a roll right now.
Amazing.
And she's got a great band behind her.
Oh,
and
those guys are terrific.
That's the thing that I, you know, when I've seen her in recent years, that's the thing that keeps, you know, coming back to me, is that, you know, of course, she's this amazing jewel, but you have to have the correct setting for a jewel like that. Mm-hmm. And she's got a band that really just gives her all the support that she needs, and is, you know, super gritty and bluesy when she needs to do that, and just they're amazing, perfect setting for
it's
her.
It's more like the band than the brass soul band that she used to tour with, and Ry Cooder was the one actually put that band together.
Oh, really?
For her.
I didn't know that.
And it's closer to Levon Helm, and, you know, she and Levon were so close.
Yeah,
you too, and I think that really suits her, and they adore her. They take such good care of her.
Yeah.
But did she ever tell you the stories about how Bob Dylan wanted to marry her?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Circling back to Dylan, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because we hung out on the tour bus, too. Yeah. So, you know, she would drop a few stories here and there. Yeah.
Good stories.
Yeah. I mean, who can blame him, really, you know?
Yeah. He was too shy, though. He asked Pops, and Pops said, "Don't ask me, ask Mavis."
Yeah.
And then he went and asked Yvonne, and she said, "Why are you asking me?" And then he never went to Mavis.
He never,
He was too shy. But she said when they toured together a couple years ago, he came in the dressing room to say hi, and she said, "You could have had this." But
you missed your chance.
Yeah.
Well, but he likes the ladies, you know.
Yeah.
He likes
but
the
with the Dylan songs, I mean, you know, there are so many of them. And you chose a few that people think, oh, yeah, I see. But you chose some that people might not have thought you'd. What was your criteria? And once you started making those songs your own, were there any surprises or things you discovered in getting to know the songs better?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, it's such a huge body of work. So on the one hand, that's a good thing because you have an almost infinite number of songs to choose from. And then on the other hand, you're like, what, you know, how am I going to pick what to do? Because there's just so many great songs and, you know, so many like really great, devastatingly good songs that if you ever wrote one of those songs, you would just be able to die happy that you did that one thing. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to narrow this down in some way. And one of the things that I wanted to do was to touch on different eras of his career, because, of course, people are very familiar with the, you know, the stuff from the 60s and even the 70s. And, you know, that was sort of, I guess, what you would call his sort of prime of being like a big rock star and being a big cultural influential figure. But he also continued to write amazing songs and continued to put out records that, you know, even if the record as a whole wasn't just drop-dead brilliant all the way through, there would be these brilliant songs in there. So I wanted to do some songs from the Oh Mercy record, you know, which is one of my favorite records, and came out in the 80s. And yeah, it was not, I think it came at the end of a string of records that, you know, his audience just kept sort of getting more and more and more mystified. And a lot of them had decided that they just weren't going to pay attention anymore. And then he drops this Oh Mercy record, which I just thought was brilliant. So I wanted to do the song Ring Them Bells from that record. I wanted to do something from the 2001 album Love and Theft, which is brilliant, brilliant record. So we put High Water on there. And so that was one of my criteria, was to pick things from throughout his career. And just, you know, it's not like people don't know that he's still great, but that was just one of the things that I wanted to demonstrate, is like, it's not just about the 60s and 70s, but he's continued to to change as an artist and continue to put out great music. And then the other thing was to have a few things that I knew people would be very familiar with. A song like Highway 61 Revisited. You know, most people who know Dylan know that song. Sure. And then to also put in some songs that people were less familiar with. And I guess maybe the one from Empire Burlesque, oh gosh, now I'm blanking on the title. I put it on the record. I don't remember the name of it. Dark Eyes, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, Dark Eyes, which is from Empire Burlesque. And I didn't even know about that song until Patti Smith told me about it. And she was like, oh, I heard you're doing this thing. You should check out this song. You know?
Patti would know. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a Dylan scholar herself, so.
Yeah, and she's Patti Smith.
And she's Patti Smith, yeah. So pretty much anything she tells you to do, you're going to do. Yeah,
you take notes. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, are you going to, you still do some of the Dylan stuff in your sets? Like, what, if people see you tomorrow night, what can they expect?
Yeah, well, I mean, we do, some of the shows that we do are just a Songs of Bob Dylan show, so we do a lot of the songs. But, you know, right now I'm also coming to the end of a process of making another new record, which is original material. So I also like to preview some of the brand new stuff. Great. And then, which it's not out yet, but I like to give people a little bit of a taste of that. And then, you know, songs from Relish or songs from some of the other records, you know, we mix it up.
You remember the lyrics? That was adorable, though. You were precious. Because anybody else would have just started crying and run off the stage, but you were very sweet.
Oh my God,
so,
no.
You were wonderful.
You know, embarrassment is kind of, it's built into the whole job description. So
yeah.
you do it enough times, you get used to it. So,
well, you didn't set out to be a songwriter. You were originally more interested in film.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Kentucky, and I moved to New York City to go to NYU to study filmmaking. And in the process, I became really fascinated with documentary film, and that's what I thought I was going to be. It was like a, you know, documentary filmmaker or somebody on a news team or something. And it really was just by accident that I ended up falling into this music scene that was going on in New York at the time. It was kind of like a dare. You know, there was a guy in my building who invited me out for a drink, and the first bar on the corner was a blues bar, this place that doesn't exist anymore. It was called the Abilene Cafe. And there was a piano player there who, like, they had finished their set, but he was just playing for himself and the handful of people that were still in this bar. And this guy was like, I dare you to go up and sing a song with him. And I was like, okay, I will. And so I sang this Billie Holiday song, God Bless the Child.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And which that was the one that we both knew. So we did that. And he was like, you know, that's pretty good. You should come back. We have an open mic session here every Tuesday night. So I started going to this open mic blues jam, and I would, you know, sign up and you know, sing my two little songs. And there was just something that really, it just really captivated me. And I feel like, I think because I was in this mindset of doing an art form, which is very much about, you know, filmmaking is very much about technology, and it's very much about, it's like a mental process. And I love that, but I think that's a danger for me, is to get too much up in my head and neglect the other parts of my being. And the thing about music is you can't do that.
Right.
You can't come at music from only a mental thing. It's a spiritual thing. It's a physical thing. It's an emotional thing. And I think all those things really just activated these parts of me and brought back to life these parts of me that I had been pushing aside and didn't want to deal with. So it was a real, it was kind of a reckoning for me, and but it was also like a blossoming. I just felt so freed. And in particular, the kind of music that, you know, these that I was doing and that these jam sessions were about, you know, blues music and soul music and rhythm and blues music, and just it's such a release, and it's so emotional and it's so joyful. Even, you know, even like a down and dirty, awful blues song, there's a joy to it.
Right.
And, you know, and that really just turned me around. And you know, eventually I got into all these other, you know, I found out where the other open mic nights were, and I met other musicians, and they said, oh, why don't you come down and sing one song with my band tonight or whatever. And I just got into this scene that was happening at the time, and just sucked me in. And
well,
I've never come back out again.
You know? Now they're making documentaries about you, you know. So there you go. So how did you make the transition from that to Relish?
I mean, it was many years. I started to from the musicians that I met, I put together a band of my own, and you know, took my little demo tape around to all the clubs where I had done the open mic night and tried to get them to pay me to sing, and that took, you know, many months of getting refused. And finally, one guy was like, "Sure, I'll give it a, you know, give you a try." And you know, I made sure that everyone that I knew about this show, and I was like, harangued people, "Please come," because I knew that if I could fill this place up, this little club, that he would give me another booking. So we did this show, and I mean, I was terrified, and I was like sick to my stomach for 2 or 3 days beforehand, and I was not a natural, you know, person who likes to get up in front of people. I was really, really frightened and really nervous. And, you know, I grew up in Kentucky, so to be playing a you know, gig in New York City, I was like, ah. So it was terrifying, but I did it, and I got used to doing it because I was lucky enough to get another gig, and then from that I got other gigs, and at a certain point I was playing 5 or 6 nights a week in these clubs in New York City. And from there, I branched out to Washington, D.C., and upstate New York, and Boston, and Philly, and Burlington, Vermont, and just anywhere within a day's drive, we started to go and get gigs there. And once I became sort of like a regional person who had a bit of a following and a bit of a reputation, then, you know, once you've done most of the work yourself, the record companies will come in and say, oh, let's sign you to a contract.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sort of a proof of concept of like, oh, this will work on this scale. Let's see if we can't scale it up and make some money off of it.
And you never worked at Hooters, but you worked with Hooters.
Let's
make that transition, because some people might think Hooters. She was a waitress.
No,
you worked with. In fact, they were the ones that wrote One of Us. Which
Eric Bazilian, who's a member of the band The Hooters. Yeah. They were the guys who The guy who signed me is a guy named Rick Chertoff, and he's also a producer. He produced Cyndi Lauper records, and, you know, he's had a bunch of big hit songs. And he signed me to the label, and he also produced the Relish record. And he brought in these guys from a band called The Hooters, who were great multi-instrumentalists, great songwriters, and we just basically spent like a year, you know, just doing nothing but working on the songs, working on the arrangements, writing, recording, and, you know, it was nothing that I could have ever afforded to do on my own, because they, you know, that's one thing the record company will do is say, okay, here's some money for you to stop doing anything else except focusing on right. making a record. And so that's what we did, and that's how Relish came about.
And you didn't ever imagine it being a rock star that all of a sudden we got a big hit and you're a girl from Kentucky and all of a sudden that song just exploded.
Yeah. It was
did you see that coming?
Thing. No.
No, okay.
No, I did not. Yeah. Rick Chertoff, he knew. He knew that okay. He was like, this might be a hit song. So he had that idea. But I was like, what, are you kidding me? No way. This weird little song? No.
Yeah, you don't strike me as the kind of want to go out and be a big star and ride around in a limo and stuff, but all of a sudden you were famous.
Yeah.
And what baggage did that bring?
I mean, you know, on the one hand, any time that you have a success on that level as an artist, mm-hmm. you have to be nothing but grateful. You know, that something yes. that you had a hand in creating mm-hmm. and presenting to the world has real meaning for people, and not just a few people, but a lot of people, mm-hmm. and not just people in your home country, but people in other parts of the world. Right. You know, I mean, that's something that I will be forever grateful for, because mm-hmm. if you are an artist, there's nothing more satisfying than that. You know, just as a person, there were parts of it that I didn't enjoy. You know, it was kind of like going back to junior high school, where you just feel like everybody's, you know, judging you and writing stuff about you in the press, and like, oh, she's this or she's that, or who does she think she is, or what's with the nose ring, or, you know, and I just, you know, I felt very uncomfortable about that, and I was like, oh my God, yeah, all this scrutiny is just, like, I'm, you know, I was not a person who felt like I was like glamorous rock star material, so those kind of things made me very uncomfortable, and just not really having any privacy. Like, I was used to living in New York City and just going around and doing whatever, and, you know, and suddenly everywhere I went, people recognized me, and, you know, they would like follow me down the street or pull up next to me in traffic and honk their horns, or, you know, I'd go into a drugstore to like buy some tampons, and there's like three people following me through the aisles, and I'm like, oh my God, you know. So I understand now how people who are in that position, you know, create these cocoons around themselves to protect sure. themselves from yes. that. But I didn't have any of that, and I didn't really, that wasn't really my style. I didn't want to have to rely on other people to do all this stuff for me. And I felt like there was a certain kind of infantilizing that does to mm-hmm. you, and I didn't want that. So it was a little bit weird. But, you know, having said that, it was a great thing, and I will never... you know, I will never not be grateful for that, and it was wonderful. Mm. And I think it's part of the reason that I still have a job today doing this. You know.
And you get to do what you want. You don't have to feel like you have to top that success, commercial success.
Yeah, I did feel like that after that record came
pressure.
Out, and that was a rough. That was a rough time. Yeah. But that's years and years ago, and now I'm kind of in this really sort of sweet position of having enough of an audience that people, you know, will follow me and to hear what I'm doing next, and they're interested, and they come to the shows, and I can support myself and, you know, save money for my daughter's college tuition and all that. But it's not such a huge amount that there's all these people who are like, oh, you know, this is our livelihood too, so we need to make you do this or that, or we think you should do this or that, and so there isn't that kind of pressure.
No, you still have the best of both worlds. You have the success, but you still have your life, and you're still, as far as we can see, sane. You know, you know, that's
as far
a
as
miracle,
you know,
in this
yeah.
business. Yeah, it could be. Yeah, the video for One of Us was terrific too. I don't know if you had any input in that, since you had interest in film, but it was really so many videos then were just getting stupid, but that was such a compelling. I mean, really, you watched MTV, you know what I mean? Okay, but it was really a compelling video. I actually used to use it for high school classes,
really?
Like theology. I was trying to get I played Like a Virgin, or no, Like a Prayer,
okay.
Madonna,
yeah.
You know, and talk about St. Martin Dupuy. The nuns never taught us about it, but I learned about it in a Madonna video, you know. the whole interracial aspect of a black saint and a white woman. And they all got freaked out about
everybody,
the kiss. But,
yeah.
And so I was showing these Nirvana videos and stuff in churches, and it was kind of scandalous. But when one of the priests asked me, well, like, what do you talk about? What do you show? And I mentioned yours. And I said, well, there's some controversy because some of the fundamentalists think is disrespectful.
Right.
Because he said, well, what do you mean? I said, like, well, what if God was one of us, just a slob like one of us on the train? And he goes, oh, I guess they never read about Jesus then, did they? Because your song really reached these young, this is high school age, really touched them because it made this whole spirituality thing relatable. It didn't dumb it down. It made it relatable. I think it was a powerful song.
Yeah, well, I you know, Eric wrote this great song, and the thing that when I heard it, the thing that really kind of struck me about it was the lyric is almost like something that a little child would come up and ask you when they don't know any better, and they ask you this question that really sets you on your heels because it's, you know, they don't have all these sort of, you know, learned things of like, oh yeah, well, we just sort of all go along with this thing and we don't really think about it anymore. Yeah. They're just discovering all these things. So I thought there was something very innocent about asking the question in that way. And also that it is a question. It's not telling you what you're supposed to think. It's asking you to sort of search your heart. And I do feel like there's echoes of the, you know, the Good Samaritan story of, you know, if there's someone who's just, you know, a stranger on the bus or someone who's in this lowly position, you know, what are you going to do toward, how are you going to be towards that person? And, you know, Jesus was saying that however you treat the least of my, you know, people is how you treat me as well. So that was the way that I connected with it.
You mean like immigrants?
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yes.
There's that.
Oh, God.
And while we're on the theology, how about the St. Teresa song, not just because it was my patron saint, St. Teresa the Little Flower, but Terry's a nickname of Teresa. But,
yes, it is.
But it's a totally different story than people would expect, and I wonder if you could give us some background on that, and from your own personal experience, how you were inspired by somebody you saw on the street.
Yeah, the St. Teresa thing was, I mean, one of the things that I used to try to do when writing a song, and you know, sometimes I still do it, is to make a song that is kind of like a little movie, where you describe scenes and scenes and scenes. And I guess, you know, coming from a film background, that's, you know, that's where I got that. And the Saint Teresa character is a person that I used to see. I lived in the East Village in New York City, and I would sit in my window and look down on the street, and I saw this woman night after night after night who was selling drugs. Probably she was just, you know, selling a dime bag or whatever, and she had a stroller with her and a baby in the stroller as she was doing this. And, you know, part of me, of course, was like, oh, clutching my pearls of like, how can she do this? And then another part of me was like, well, if you're a drug dealer, you probably don't have a lot of good options for childcare. And, you know, maybe this is the best way that she knows how to do this and to provide for this baby is to, you know, like, I don't know her story. So I noticed that as I looked around that, you know, in New York City, you've got, you know, here you're on this side of the street, and here's all these other windows on this side of the street, and, you know, people could be looking out of their window and watching this person. And I started to kind of imagine, what if there was somebody who was also watching her, but sort of became obsessed with her, and went down and was a customer of hers, and, you know, created this whole story in his mind of how, you know, if he's under the influence of these substances that she's selling him, then he becomes very fixated on her and about her and the baby, and, you know, what could that unfold as a song? So it was kind of there's a sort of a mysterious quality about it because it's through the lens of this person who, you know, maybe they're high on these substances that this woman is selling him, and you know, has fixated on this person and created this sort of sanctified character out of her. You know, so that's, you know, I've also heard people tell me what that song means to them, and it has nothing to do with that.
Sure.
And I like that. You know,
sure.
I want to have, you know, I want songs to be, like, I know what they mean to me. But if they're written in an open enough way, mm-hmm. then you also could have your own story that you fill in those lyrics, and that it could be just as powerful for you. And that, to me, like, I feel like of all the songs I've written, that's one of the more successful ones because it's got that aspect mm-hmm. to it.
Mm-hmm. And that's art, you know, where people can put their own interpretation in there, and it's great. Mm-hmm. Now,
should we talk some like about Bob Dylan?
Yeah,
but, I mean, I don't want to. It's
no,
you're
no,
doing
no.
Your
but
job,
I just want to get a little more into your songwriting because we have the songwriter.
I mean, I talk about
here.
Me all night, but
if Dylan wants to talk about songwriting, he can show up. But we have a great songwriter here, so if, just a couple more, then we get back to Dylan.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's okay. I'm just going to yell at requests at your show tomorrow night. So, you know. No, but that you wrote that song a long time ago. How many years ago was that? It was
like 20,
yeah. That's a long time ago.
Years ago. Yeah.
When you write now, is it a different type of experience, or is it a continuation of that?
Well, you know, I feel like there are many, many different ways to write a song. And I used to think, oh, it's got to be this way, and if it's not like this, and it's not cool enough, or it's not hip enough, or whatever, then it's not good. I really try to banish all of those thoughts. And, you know, like you take a Hank Williams song, that's just about as simple as you can possibly get and as direct as you can possibly get. Mm-hmm. So anything on that continuum from that to, you know, like, say, a Bob Dylan song that's got complicated, weird, surrealist imagery, and you don't even know what the hell he's talking about, but it's, you know, but you know it's super deep, and, you know, so there's anything along that continuum is okay and is legitimate, and, you know, because songs, they, you know, they have different jobs to do, and they have different people that they're supposed to go out and reach, or they're supposed to reach you at a different moment in your life or a different time of day. So any kind of song that is successful is okay in my book. So I've really kind of opened myself up to different kinds of writing, and you know, there's a record that I did a handful of years ago called Love and Hate. Some of those songs are much more just simple and direct, and just trying to speak something very plainly. You know, this next record that I'm writing is really kind of in reaction to just what's happened in America in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. So some of the songs are political songs, mm-hmm. and I've tried to actually learn from the way that Bob Dylan writes political songs to make them general enough and maybe, I don't know, mythic enough, mythopoetic enough that they could live in this time, but they could also be talking about another time as well. So some of them are political songs, and some of them are songs that are trying to, you know, latch on to a sense of hope and a sense of optimism, because I think that's one of the things that music really can do for us in this moment, is to renew us when we're feeling discouraged. And I have, you know, moments and days when just the events of the last couple of years just leave me feeling really discouraged and also depleted to try to help all the people that are asking for help and that legitimately need help. If you're trying to be a good citizen, you know, you can feel like overwhelmed and like you can't do enough, and it really depletes you. So part of the reason that I wanted to write this new record was to you know, look to the future, to a time when it can be better, and to believe in that. Because if you don't believe in that, I think it's hard to manifest it.
Yeah.
And also to just re-energize myself. Some of the songs are just like, I want to stand up and play this song with a rock band, and it's going to make me feel good, and it's going to make people dance. And that's what we all need, is to connect with that sense of joy. You know?
Sure do.
Because without it, we're not going to be successful, I don't think.
Well, that's one of the things in my class at Columbia we've talked about in the last couple of years, is we study the late 60s, early 70s, when music was so political, and of mm-hmm. course Dylan was in the forefront of that, and then it seemed to kind of go away, but we're now in the process of discovering how artists are responding to what's going on now, mm-hmm. and drawing attention to that and saying that's not something from the past, that's something, and those good songs from the past still feed us like they did then, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of artists putting out new material like yourself and new younger artists who are really tapping into the anxiety and the, mm-hmm. you know, but that's one of the roles of the artist, isn't it? To really help people come together and focus and move forward and
inspire.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, there are certainly people who will say that art, you know, it's only, art is just what it is, and it doesn't have to have some greater meaning, and it doesn't have to be, you know, political or social or important or anything like that. And I think that's legitimate too. But I think there is a function of art within, you know, society and within politics and all that, which is, it's very unique function, because it bypasses certain parts of your, you know, conscious mind, and it goes into deeper parts of you and allows you to connect with it in that way. And I think it's mysterious, and I don't think we really understand it completely, but it is an important thing to do.
It really,
you know,
is.
And it brings us together as a community as well. And I think in particular, that is one of the most important things that we need art and music to do for us right now, because we're in such a place where, you know, people just are hating on each other so much, you know, and it's that's not good, you know.
That's what Mavis is doing now. She's singing about building bridges and
Absolutely.
Bringing people together, and we need that. It's just, wow. And then back to Motown for a minute, there are some great songwriters like Smokey Robinson and Holland Doizer and Holland.
Mm-hmm.
And in the midst of all the chaos of the 60s and social upheaval, they were writing songs that gave us joy.
Yeah.
And we needed sometimes to, and sometimes they don't get the credit they deserve as songwriters. You know,
mm-hmm.
we'll talk about Dylan and,
mm-hmm.
and Lennon McCartney and all that. But these guys wrote art. It was Tears of a Clown, all those
Absolutely.
Songs.
Absolutely. Oh, my God, what a great song. Yeah.
And
really, too, you know, you look at something like the Motown phenomenon or Stax music or, you know, I'm sure that this is something you touch on in your class. It's, you know, this was a revolutionary way for people to cross the color barriers.
Yes.
You know, because, and it was done not at, you know, not in some sort of like fist-shaking, you know, overtly political way, but it was done through joy, and it was done through fun and enjoyment and laughter and love. And, you know, those things are incredibly powerful, and it made it okay for, you know, white people to listen to black music, or for black people to perform for white people, and you know those barriers, you know, in particular in the South, were completely intransigent, and it took the joy of music to erode those in a way. You know, that was one of the things that that allowed those barriers to come down, and I think we need that just as much today as we ever did. You know?
Well, I always tell my students that Dr. King owed a great debt to music and baseball. It won hearts and minds. It humanized.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just an issue. Legislation's important, but you also need that, you know, not just the head, as you were talking about with film. You need all this stuff, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Lennon McCartney, by the way, you and I got to type on John Lennon's typewriter today. We got to go to the head of the class.
It's not out here right now, but they're going to have a thing where they bring out the typewriters of, you know, famous authors and writers, and I got to type on John Lennon's typewriter.
Oh, my God. That was so cool. And I do a show called Breakfast with the Beatles Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 on 93XM. And tomorrow I'm playing Hey Bulldog that you did at one of the
song.
Tribute concerts to John Lennon in New York City.
Yeah.
And I dropped your name. You might be getting a call someday from the San Diego Symphony. They wanted to do a Beatle tribute, and I said, don't get a tribute band with a guy with a wig and the left-hand bass player. Call you, call Ben Harper, call, you know.
Oh, that would be great.
So you might be getting a call someday. I'm working on it.
Okay.
Okay, but how did that music speak to you, the Lennon-McCartney stuff? I know you love John Lennon and stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, the White Album was one of the first records that I ever listened to, as a 11-year-old kid in Kentucky.
Kentucky.
It was very adult. Like, I could tell that this was something for adults, and the number 9 song used to freak me out, and I had to pick up the needle and go past it, because it terrified me.
Did you listen to it in the dark?
When I went over to some friends' house, that was that was a big dare. It was like, we'll all turn the lights off and listen to number 9, yeah.
Scary.
Uh-huh. But I feel like that sort of imprinted on me in a way, because it was such a diverse collection of songs, like, from one song to the next, it was so different. And I feel like that when I was starting to write my own music and starting to write the Relish record or whatever, it, you know, for me that was like, oh, you know, it doesn't have to, these songs don't all have to sound the same, or they don't all have to have the same instrumentation or whatever, because, I mean, you know, look at the Beatles. They did whatever they wanted, and they created something that everybody could understand, but each song was so different from the rest. And I think that gave me a kind of permission in a way to do something like that.
Well, it was Bob Dylan that challenged John Lennon to write lyrics that mattered, and so his influence was there. How did Dylan influence you? Why did you choose Dylan as your first project?
Well, you know, the thing about Dylan's music that I have always tried to, you know, to keep in mind. I mean, you know, you can try to emulate somebody like that. Of course, you're never going to do it because, you know, he's him and I'm me, and he's a fantastic super genius, and, you know, the Shakespeare of rock and roll and whatever. But you can learn from people like that. And the thing that, in particular, in this, you know, you were asking me about why did I choose it before, but I want to talk a little bit about what I'm trying to do with this new group of songs and why I think it's important to look at him as a model in this way. And it's, you know, he was able to write political songs. I mean, that song that I started with, Serve Somebody, I mean, that comes from his born-again Christian phase. But if you play that song now, there's so many lyrics in it that seem to be speaking to us directly about this moment that we're in now. Because it's not about a particular event that happened. It's about corruption. And it's about, you know, are you going to make a choice, you know, no matter what walk of life you're on, no matter how powerful you are in you know, in the world, or how lowly you are, you have to make a choice of, you know, what is your moral compass going to be? Are you going to, you know, are you going to serve the Lord, or are you going to serve the devil? And I think you can look around you right now and see that there's a whole lot of people who've decided they're going to serve the devil. You know, and they straight up have made that choice, and they're, you know, even gleeful about it. You know, so I think it's you know, that is a song that, you know, I can get up and sing that night after night and feel like I'm talking about whatever was on the news this morning, because it's about, you know, the basic human thing of, you know, what is your choice going to be? And the basic human thing, which has happened all throughout history, of being corrupt and deciding that you're going to be greedy, and you're going to be in it for yourself, and you're going to serve that which is destructive to other people. Mm. So it's really about, you know, that song is really an example for me of a way to write a song that is a political song, but it's also something that could speak to what's happening now. It could speak to what's happening 10 years from now, 20
exactly.
years ago, 150
yeah.
years ago, like whatever. So I've really, you know, tried to take that, you know, a page from his book in that way. And, you know, there's so many of his songs that are like that. And they, you know, if you want to talk about maybe the, you know, the song Highway 61 Revisited, you know, it's such a you know, fantastical, you know, kind of talking blues song. But you can also take the little stories that he talks about in the song, and they're also talking about things that are happening today. Mm. And, you know, because that is, I think, one of the greatest things about his genius, is being able to write something which in a way is almost nonsensical, or in a way is almost sort of mythopoetic, but doing it in such a way that everybody who hears it is going to be like, oh, I know what he's talking about. He's talking about that thing that I just heard about. Or I know what he's talking about. He's talking about me and this choice that I have to make.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've always thought of, like, Dylan, especially with, like, A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, songs like that. Mm-hmm. And then back to Mavis again, too, since they almost got married. But she did a song with the Gorillaz a while back where, you know, Mavis is always so happy and upbeat. She was angry in the song, and she's singing, you know, it's times are coming. What's going? What are you going to do? And it's like the out in the desert, there's that prophet yelling out truth to power, and people are ridiculing them and saying, oh, you don't get it. You know, you're never going to whatever. But it's the courage of some of these artists that that do things like that. That because Dylan was mocked and reviled too when came out. Couldn't sing, you know, his voice was, you know, but it turns out his voice was an instrument.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. He's a great communicator as a singer. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
We'd love to hear a song, because I hear in addition to being a good conversationalist, you're a good singer and songwriter.
You know, depends on the day. Let's see. Well, since I mentioned it, I'm going to try to do Highway 61 Revisited.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Hey.
Woo! All right.
Takes courage.
Yeah. Let's see.
God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Abe said, where you want this killing done? God said, down on Highway 61. Mac the Finger said, oh, that's the wrong lyrics. Here we go. One, two, three, four. Georgia Sam had a bloody nose. The welfare department wouldn't give him no clothes. He asked poor Howard, where can I go? Howard said, there's only one place that I know. And Sam said, tell me quick, man. Ooh, I gotta run. Howard just pointed with his gun and said, that way down Highway 61. Mac the Finger said to Louis the King, I got 40 red, white, and blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. Do you know where I can get rid of these things? And Louis the King said, let me think for a minute, son. He said, yes, I think it can be easily done. Just take it all down to Highway 61. Well, the fifth daughter on the 12th night told the first father that things weren't right. My complexion, she said, is much too white. He said, come here and step into the light. He said, you're right. Let me tell a second mother this has been done. But the second mother was with a seventh son, and they were both down on Highway 61. The roving gambler, he was very bored. He was trying to create the next world war. He found a promoter who nearly fell off the floor. Said, I've never engaged in this kind of thing before, but yes, I think it can be very easily done. We'll just put some bleachers out in the sun and have it down on Highway 61.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, best-selling author Jennifer Finney Boylan discusses her memoir, Good Boy, My Life in Seven Dogs, with special guest Kathy Griffin. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.